This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, if you need an excuse to not shovel snow, our guest has a pretty good one. It could save your heart, maybe even your life. His advice applies to people younger than you might think. We'll find out how to shovel safely and who he says should find other ways to remove that snow. Now we know how to use masks and social distancing, quarantining and vaccines, but at-home testing is a newer part of our toolkit for slowing the spread of COVID-19. Starting this weekend, private insurers will have to provide up to 8 free tests a month to clients who request them, and people who aren't insured should be able to get free tests at community health centers. But there's a lot of information out there on at-home testing, and it can get very confusing. So we're learning now how and when to use rapid at-home antigen tests for COVID-19. And we want to hear what you're thinking or wondering about at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about at-home COVID test kits? Have you been using them? How has it changed your ability to live safely during the pandemic? Are you confused about the timing, when you're supposed to use one of these tests? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Chana Davis is a geneticist and founder of the science information site Fueled by Science. She's also a contributing writer for Dear Pandemic. Chana, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get to some of the particulars, when and how we use these things, what are you seeing now from this new announcement from the Biden administration trying to make the tests more available in the first place?
Well, I'm thrilled to see this announcement because these tests have very much been underutilized throughout the pandemic, not because of interest, but because of lack of access. So it remains to see exactly how this will roll out, but I think it certainly looks like a very promising step in the right direction.
And before we, again, get into the particulars, how helpful a tool are these rapid tests? How big a difference could a regular usage and regular access make?
I think it can make a huge difference as long as people really have a deep understanding of both the strengths and the limitations of these tests. They can be problematic if they're misinterpreted, but they can be extremely helpful if they're used appropriately.
All right. Well, let's get into the strengths. First of all, what are the pros? What are the most useful elements of these tests when used correctly? And we'll get to that in a bit.
Yeah, their key strength is that they can give you an answer quickly at home. So they're often compared to PCR tests, which can give you, which take longer, but can detect a smaller amount of virus. So, you know, given the bottleneck in PCR right now, you know, a PCR test is the gold standard for telling you whether or not there's any trace of COVID in your body, but it's just not realistic for the whole country to be doing that on a regular basis. These have the potential to be available at scale and to be used on a regular basis for routine monitoring of whether or not you have COVID-19.
And you mentioned key limitations. What are those?
The key limitation is their sensitivity. So because you have to have a lot of virus in your body for these to give you a positive test, a negative test is somewhat inconclusive, a single negative test, that is. You really have to do multiple negative tests to really be sure you don't have it.
But the big thing is we can be pretty sure we do have it if we get a positive result. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. So when you're looking at any type of diagnostic or screening test, there's a metric called specificity, which tells you, you know, if you're getting a specificity tells you if you have a negative test, can you believe it? And sensitivity tells you, are you going to catch all the true positive cases? So these tests, they have about a 99% specificity, which means that only a small percent of the cases are going to be false positives. Now, there's a little bit of nuance here that I want to bring up because whether or not a positive result is a true positive or a false positive depends a lot on the context of that test. So when these tests were first rolled out in the summer when cases were low, if you use these on people with a very low risk of having COVID, they don't have symptoms, they're not in a high community situation, you could actually have more false positives than real positives. But if you're using them now, when COVID is everywhere and using them on people that have symptoms, when you look at the whole set of positive tests, the vast majority of them will be true positives. And for that reason, a lot of places, including where I live here in Vancouver, are no longer requiring a PCR to verify a positive test. It's because your pre-test probability is high, then that makes it even more likely that your positive is a true positive.
Talking to Chana Davis, geneticist, founder of the science info site Fueled by Science and a contributor to Dear Pandemic. We've talked to a lot of folks there over the last couple of years. We are talking about at-home rapid COVID tests, and you can get answers to your questions about how to use them, when to use them, what to do with the results. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Or if you have an experience to share using one of these tests yourself. Love to hear how it went for you, if you felt confused or if it all made sense. 800-642-1234 is the number, or you can email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring out a caller now. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi. I just wonder, if I'm out in public and I inhale some, if I inhale a virus, does that, and I test positive, does that just mean I've been exposed because there's a virus I've inhaled, or does that mean I'm infected with it? I'll hang up and listen.
Dennis, thanks for the call. Chana?
Yeah, that's a great question. So these tests, the rapid antigen tests, they will only turn positive if you have a really high amount of virus in the swab. So in this case, routinely in your nose. It's something on the order of a million virus particles. So if you have a million virus particles in that one little swab, you have a lot of virus in your body. So these rapid tests are thought to be a rough proxy of whether you're actually contagious. If you were just exposed, you would have a very, very, very small amount of your virus in your body. For the first few days after you're exposed, the virus is basically, you know, very slowly going through this process of incubating and taking over your cells, and then it explodes exponentially how much virus you have. So you will, what typically happens is it will be undetectable for a day or two, and then you'll, within another, you know, after that period, you'll have just enough virus that PCR can pick it up, and then maybe 12 to 24 hours later after that, you'll have enough for a rapid test to pick it up. And by that point, you are contagious for sure. And you may have been contagious before that as well. That's the tricky point.
Dennis, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. And Chana, that reminds me about the question of timing. So say you are at a school or a workplace, you get that notification, hey, somebody you are at work with today just tested positive for COVID. Do I rush and take that test right away, or do I have to wait it out a little bit?
Yes, it's really important to wait a little bit, especially with Omicron. Prior to Omicron, it was very common to recommend testing the day you have symptoms. So there's two situations. There's a situation where you have symptoms, and there's a situation where you have an exposure. So if it's a symptom situation, the previous advice used to be test as soon as you have symptoms because you probably have a lot of virus at that point. With Omicron, it's actually looking like the viral swabs in your nose may not pick it up until a few days after symptoms, which is an important change to be aware of, particularly with the nasal swabs. So for a symptom situation, you might even want to wait a couple of days after your symptoms, and then even then test another day after your first test if you're getting a negative the first time. If it's an exposure, you'll want to wait a few days. So by PCR, and one of the early case studies showed that a lot of people were testing positive by day 3 after exposure, but for some people it takes longer. So you want to wait, I would say at least 3 days after exposure, and longer if you can, and just take precautions in the meantime. The longer you wait, you know, somewhere between the maybe up to 5 days would be your best chance that you can really trust the result, but it's a trade-off between having the information sooner and having a better chance of detecting that signal.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Cindy is with us in Poinette. Cindy, hi.
Hello, I have a question. I just heard her say that you had to take multiple tests if you were negative, but it sounded like if you had a positive, you were COVID positive. How many tests are you supposed to take if you're going to use the at-home ones to find that you're truly negative. And, you know, they're like $25 a piece for two tests. That's my question.
Yeah, Cindy, thanks for that call. Chana, in what circumstance would we definitely want to keep going if we've had that negative test?
Yeah, well, it's all about timing. So I think we still need to see more studies on the exact dynamics of how these infections play out and what the timelines are. But we know from pre-Omicron that there's a lot of variation from person to person. So before Omicron came around, you know, a lot of people might take 5 days to turn positive, but others would take 10 days to turn positive, you know, by PCR. So there's not really going to be a one-size-fits-all answer. But the general message is that you want to test twice between days, I would say 3 and 10. Ideally, you'll test, maybe wait till day 5 to have a better chance of having a positive signal, and then test, you know, 1 to 2 days after that. If you've tested negative 2 times and the second test was after 7 days, then that's you're in pretty good shape at that situation. There will always be outliers, but that would be a reasonable recommendation.
Thanks for calling in with that question. We're talking to scientist and science communicator Chana Davis about at-home COVID testing. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you confused about how these tests work, when you're supposed to do them, what you're supposed to do with them? Call it now at 800-642-1234. Or if you're a pro at these things now because you're using them in your home or your workplace, love to hear your story. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with scientist and science communicator Chana Davis about how to make use of at-home COVID tests. Insurers will have to provide those for free starting this weekend. You could join in with your questions, your experiences using these tests at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Chris is with us in Oconomowoc. Chris, hi.
Hey, how's it going? Thank you for taking my call. I feel like we all sort of have a variant of the same kind of questions, but here's my thought is that my wife and I have been triple vaccinated. Both our kids have been vaccinated as fully as possible. We all came down with symptoms within a day or two of each other, sore throat, runny noses, and whatnot, and took, you know, been using the at-home tests for several months now, tested negative on the first day of heavy symptoms. Retook it 2 days later, and still negative. But I mean, I guess what you're saying is after 5 days is the ideal point to try to detect this. Because my question is, like, I work in the public, and I'm trying to decide the right thing to do, mm-hmm. you know, when going out, and you can't get a PCR test within 5 days these days nowadays.
Sure. And Chris, just to be clear, did you ever in these home tests get a positive test during those symptoms, or were they all negative?
They were all negative.
Okay.
And again, this is anecdotal, but like I talked to, you know, dozens of other coworkers and friends who had the exact same symptoms. Some tested positive, some tested negative. But I don't know if the level of vaccination you've had affects your viral load.
Chris, thanks a lot for the call. I heard Chris's story. What does it make you think? What do you want to let him know?
Yeah, no, unfortunately, that's a common scenario. We're hearing a lot of reports that people are not testing on the first couple of days after symptoms. So my suspicion is that, you know, if he had tested, waited more than 2 days after symptoms, then they maybe could have got the positive. Of course, you know, colds and the flu are still out there. So not everyone who has a sore throat has COVID right now. But just really important to for after they have symptoms. And I understand.
We're kind of losing our guest here. We're going to try to reconnect, I think. We're talking to Chana Davis, geneticist, founder of the science information site Fueled by Science, also contributing writer for Dear Pandemic, answering your questions about COVID-19 at-home testing. There's more of them out there, maybe not as much as people want. Some new changes from the Biden administration looking to get more of these in the hands of individuals, of families, and to get a lot more to schools as well. raising lots of questions for people about when, how to make sense of these tests. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. While you're there, let us know if you've taken these tests, if you have experience doing them. How did it go? Did it all make sense to you, or was it kind of baffling, as it has been to many people? Don't be shy. You wouldn't be alone if that's the case. Still working to reconnect with our guest, Chana Davis. We'll be talking more about COVID and COVID-related issues, of course, in the days and weeks to come. If you have a question about testing or anything related to COVID, let us know what is on your mind, and we can use it maybe to shape a future conversation. You can email anytime, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. We've got Chana Davis back. Chana, thanks. Sorry about that. We're losing our connection there. You're responding to that story about testing when everybody had symptoms.
Yeah, so let me just share one of the recent preprint studies that came out. They found that in the first 2 days of symptoms, there was not a very good signal in the nasal swabs. They actually found, interestingly, a much stronger signal in the saliva than in the nasal samples. But after day three of symptoms, then the rapid test started to catch a lot of cases. When I said earlier day five, that's assuming you have, you know, some ability to wait that long. I think you can definitely get a very solid signal day three after symptoms, but you can be even more assured if you only have that one test. Maybe you want to wait a little bit longer to make sure you're not going to get a false negative. But you can certainly get a pretty solid read at day three after symptoms.
Let's go back to our callers now. Alan is with us in Madison. Alan, hi.
Hello. Now, this may be a bit of a naive question, but we're all using these tests, and we infect this little bit of liquid. You know, you put the nasal swab thing in the liquid and all, and we dump it. Is this bad for the environment? I mean, are we putting nature or animals or even ourselves in trouble? I mean, aren't you just supposed to dump it? But it doesn't seem like it's the right thing to do if it's, you know, full of germs.
Alan, interesting question. Chana, disposal of our COVID tests, especially if they're positive ones, do we worry about somehow spreading the viruses that way?
That's an interesting question. They do often include a biohazard bag, so I would recommend sealing everything up in that biohazard bag before you put it in the trash.
Alan, thanks a lot. A question probably a lot of people's minds as they use these. Thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. Aaron is with us next in West Bend. Aaron, hi.
Hey, how you doing? Question I have for you is specifically with your recommendation that if you can, you wait till day five with the testing. So there's just already a lot of anecdotal, just seeing it's like a coin toss as to what we're going to get from a test, you know, the first time positive, second time negative, whatnot, and back and forth. However, if we're going to wait till day five, that would almost have to be making the assumption that the possibility of having the Delta variant isn't a possibility for you, because you would have now waited too long if you actually had Delta.
Mm.
What do you think about that?
Ooh, Delta, Omicron, and test timing, Chana.
Yeah. Well, I think, again, we don't have enough really gory details on this yet, but I think the basic trajectories are similar. So what I actually have a time course from my son, who we rapid tested him every day over the break, and he got Omicron on Christmas Day. So in his case, which is a fairly typical example, we saw a super faint signal the first day, which was actually only 48 hours after. So that was a little bit earlier than you might normally expect. But you see a really faint signal the day that the virus is starting to take hold, which will be a different day for different people. And then it will be strong for a good solid 5-6 days after that. You have a really, you know, maybe a 5-6 day really sweet spot where you're going to get a strong signal. And then for a few days after that, it starts to slowly taper off. So you'll see a faint signal for the next 3 days or possibly slightly longer after that. And for Delta and Omicron, I don't think it's really dramatically different. It's just shifted a day or so earlier for Omicron, this whole process.
Thanks for that call. I want to spend some time, Chana, on, okay, we've got our test at home. We've used it. What do we do with the information it provides? I mean, if we're just testing and going on about our daily lives with no change, I guess testing isn't going to help much. What do we do with the signals we get from the test, and how do we alter our behavior?
I think the key is to really take action on the positive tests, which there are a lot of. We're hearing about the cases that were missed, but there are a lot of cases that have been caught. And so that's assuming that a positive test is a true positive. And then the second piece of information is if you're having a negative, to be kind of view that with a grain of salt, especially if it's your first negative test, and to basically be acting as if you could still be positive at that point.
And with that, you mentioned that there was a positive test in your own household. And this is a big question for people. If somebody in my household tests positive, what can we do to try to make sure everybody doesn't end up with it? Could you take a minute to share the precautions we could take at home?
Sure. Yeah. You know, before when this happened to us, I sort of thought it almost might be futile and maybe we should just give up. You know, I've got a 10-year-old and 2 6-year-olds, and I thought, how on earth am I going to keep everyone separate? But what we did, and is commonly recommended, is to prioritize sleeping apart if you have the space to do so. And same with having a bathroom, a separate bathroom, you know, having the infected person use a different bathroom if at all possible. So we did both of those things. The third thing we did is to invest in high quality masks for everyone to wear. So we did not go as far as keeping my son in his own room the entire time, that which would be the utmost level of precaution. But for people where that's not realistic and young kids and so on, putting on high quality N95 or better masks really goes a long way. So that's what we did. We spent time together on the main level, but we had my son sitting at a distance and we all wore the masks the entire time. Ventilation is also an extra layer, but it was really, really cold here, and we just didn't open the doors. We were really grateful. Apparently, the masks must have done the trick.
Chana, thanks so much for sharing this advice and answering our questions.
You're very welcome.
Chana Davis is a geneticist and founder of the science info site Fueled by Science. She's a contributing writer for Dear Pandemic. She talked to us about at-home COVID testing. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, how healthy is American democracy? The effort to overturn the 2020 presidential election results is raising concerns about the peaceful transition of power. Kate Archer-Kent and her guests look at the threats and possible solutions. It's tomorrow morning on the Ideas Network. Regular listeners may know that I'm a big fan of games, and I'm always on the lookout to discover a cool new board game. Well, here's a cool new discovery of a very old board game, 4,000 years old. As reported by the Smithsonian Magazine, archaeologists working at a site in the Middle Eastern country of Oman on the Arabian Peninsula found a game board carved on a largish stone slab. The board has a grid and cup holes to hold playing pieces. The find dates back to a period before 2000 BC. It's not quite the oldest game ever discovered. That's a Mesopotamian game called the Royal Game of Ur about 4,600 years ago, and it's apparently something like a modern backgammon. With this new old game, we're not sure how to play it. Bad news, they didn't find a rule book for it. Not even clear there was a rule book. I don't know, maybe just looked up the rules online back then. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the rights to digital images called non-fungible tokens are selling for tens of thousands of bucks and more. We'll learn what an NFT is and why people buy them. First, shoveling the driveway and sidewalk may not be your favorite winter activity, being out in the cold, lifting heavy loads of snow, and it takes a while. Our next guest isn't a big fan either for a different reason. He says it's particularly dangerous, can even be deadly. In fact, he knows two people who have died either during or after snow removal. If you're 45 or older, he says maybe you shouldn't even do it. But if you insist, take some basic precautions to protect your health. Dr. Barry Franklin is Director of Preventive Cardiology and Cardiac Rehabilitation at Beaumont Health in Royal Oak, Michigan, also Professor of Physiology at Wayne State University's School of Medicine and Professor of Internal Medicine at Oakland University. He's written more than 24 books, including the forthcoming GPS for Success, Behavioral Skills, Strategies, and Secrets of Superachievers. Dr. Franklin, welcome to Central Time.
Rob, it's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Well, it's a common household chore in your state and mine. Why can shoveling be dangerous?
Well, you know, I remember picking up the Detroit Free Press in 1992, and I read the following headline. In Wayne County alone, 17 heart attack deaths were attributed to exertion since the snow began Tuesday. Most of the victims were older men clearing their walks and driveways of snow. I lost two dear friends to this activity, as you alluded to, and research tells us that we lose between 1,000 and 1,500 people each year due to snow shoveling deaths. So it's a dangerous activity.
It doesn't seem like it should be that hard, but yeah, I my heart rate gets up when I shovel. There are studies comparing it to rigorous exercise. What do we find out?
Rob, we did some studies at Beaumont. We took 10 healthy guys under the age of 35. We did a maximal treadmill test on those individuals. Then on a different day, the same time of day, we had them shovel heavy, wet snow. We were astounded by the results. Heart rate and blood pressure of those subjects while they were shoveling snow skyrocketed to levels that were achieved or even greater than maximal treadmill testing. We also measured energy expenditure during snow shoveling. It was what we call six METs, or six metabolic equivalents. That's equivalent to playing singles tennis. What 60 or 70 year old would go out and would normally play singles tennis? Most importantly, we measured 10 minutes of shoveling heavy, wet snow in these guys, and the average guy in 10 minutes moved 1,920 pounds. That's almost a ton of snow. That's the weight of a mid-size automobile. So it's an extremely taxing activity.
Are there any other things about shoveling in particular that might raise the heart risk?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Five factors, I think, that contribute to it. Number one, it involves arm exercise. Arm exercise is more taxing than leg exercise. You get a higher heart rate and blood pressure response. Secondly, you're working in an upright position, but you're not walking on a treadmill. You're largely standing still. So the legs are motionless. Blood tends to pool in the lower extremities. It involves static or isometric exertion, which increases the heart rate and blood pressure. It involves breath holding or straining. And lastly, you're exposed to dangerous cold air and wind chill factors. All these factors, Rob, have a big increase in heart rate and blood pressure, while simultaneously the cold air is constricting the coronary arteries, feeding the heart muscle. As George Clooney would say, it's a perfect storm.
Talking to Dr. Barry Franklin, cardiologist at Beaumont Health in Royal Oak, Michigan, talking about the hazards of snow shoveling. Dr. Franklin, who out there listening right now should be a non-starter, like hire that neighborhood kid, whatever, just don't shovel? Who would you have that kind of absolute message for?
Well, I would highlight the fact that a major U.S. study several years ago estimated that about 85% of all U.S. adults over the age of 50 already have underlying atherosclerotic heart disease or clogged coronary arteries. So I tell people, if they're over the age of 45, if they got a history of angioplasty, bypass surgery, if they have symptoms suggestive of heart disease called angina, or if they got high cholesterol, high blood pressure, they're a cigarette smoker, these are people who are at high risk for exercise related sudden cardiac death during snow shoveling. So I say to those people, hire a plow or hire the neighborhood kid to do it for you.
Now, for people who aren't quite in that category, but, you know, are over 45, but still want to do it themselves, do you have some advice to make it safer than it could be otherwise?
Excellent question. Number one, snowblowers do reduce the demands. Our studies at Beaumont showed heart rates are about 60 beats higher while you're moving snow when shoveling versus using a snowblower. If you're shoveling, if you can push the snow rather than lifting and throwing, you're better off. Dress appropriately in layers. Use a hat, gloves, scarves. If you can, put a scarf over the mouth so you're not breathing that cold air in. Avoid heavy meals, smoking, high caffeine, alcohol consumption before shoveling. Pace yourself. Adopt a work-rest approach. Don't ignore symptoms. I tell patients, if you got pain or discomfort from your belly button on up that comes on when you're exerting yourself, shoveling snow, stop and beware of cold and windy conditions. I tell every one of our patients to paste a little label on your shovel that reads, warning, use of this instrument for snow removal may be hazardous to your health.
And maybe this is a case for when we're not shoveling, just to safely, maybe consulting with our doctor if we have worries, up our exercise game a little better so we're ready for any kind of exertion.
Yeah, you're exactly right. People who often have the problems are people who are morbidly obese, habitually sedentary, or physically inactive. So by participating in a regular exercise program, you reduce the likelihood of running into problems if you have to remove snow.
And can you remind us, before I let you go, Dr. Franklin, what are the warning signs we should be watching for when we're shoveling or any time when it comes to some kind of bad cardiac event?
Yeah. With underlying heart disease, I tell patients, if you have pain or discomfort anywhere from your belly button on up that comes on with exertion, that could be a sign of insufficient blood and oxygen flow to your heart muscle, extreme shortness of breath, irregular heart rhythm. Those are all major factors that suggest there's a potential problem. And those are people who should not be shoveling heavy, wet snow.
Dr. Franklin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, pleasure chatting with you. Thank you for the opportunity.
That's Dr. Barry Franklin, Director of Preventive Cardiology and Cardiac Rehabilitation at Beaumont Health in Royal Oak, Michigan. He joined us today to talk about how to shovel safely in our driveways and sidewalks and why he says people older than 45 may want to find another way to get the job done. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Steve Gotcher with a story about dogs and the snow.
Dog sledding has been a family affair for writer Julie Buckles. She and her husband Charlie Ray caught the bug when they first moved to northern Wisconsin. In the past, she raced with her daughter Caroline in the annual Apostle Islands dog sled race. The mother of two considered hanging it up, but she just kept on dogging it. Danielle Kading brings us this audio postcard.
If you have dogs that are kind of snippy or have a bad attitude, it just takes all the fun out of it. So actually, everyone in this kennel has a great attitude. When we moved up here, we were introduced to the racing community through the first Apostle Island sled dog race. And we also had met John and Mary Thiel, who run Wolf Song Mushing. They do it as a business. And they had taken, it was back when they had four dogs. They have 50 now. But when they had four dogs, they took us out and we just thought that was super fun. And Charlie and I had done some big wilderness trips. And Charlie had this idea that if we had dogs, we could go out and do winter wilderness trips. And so for my birthday one year, he built me a dog box and said we were gonna go fill it. I always thought dog sledding would end when my kids weren't interested anymore. And so Caroline had raced four races and she had been so involved with the dogs, but she was 13 and she's got sports. She's in cross country ski team. And she basically said, I'm done. Charlie and I agreed we were going to start selling, and he even started selling here on Craigslist. And he came to me to talk to me about what we should price it at. And I started to cry. And I'm like, I don't know if I'm ready to be done. A month or two later, Blair, who has a racing kennel, called me and said, I have this awesome dog named Popeye who just has a heart murmur and so he can't do longer races. Are you interested? And I don't know, just that name Popeye, I was sucked in. Every musher has a story about how it started with one dog. Kind of my rebirth in dog sledding started with one dog, and it's Popeye. And he's the loudest one in the kennel. I usually get them out four times a week minimum. They really need to be exercised at least every other day. This is their prime time. It's cold. They're ready to go. They're part of our family because with this team, I almost never ever give dogs away. Once they're here for life. I reached a point one year where we had a set of dogs that all died, and I just thought, I can't do this anymore. I can't say goodbye to any more dogs. But then a new dog comes along and you fall in love again. And you just realize that that's part of the deal. Unbite, unbite, unbite. All right, hi, hi. It's really an awesome time because I think about one thing and it's the dogs, because dog sledding is a 0 to 50 sport. You could be trotting along 1 minute and if you stop paying attention, you've gone to 50 and you've got a tangle, your team is loose. It's all consuming. And so when you're out, this is all you're thinking about. But then every once in a while, my mind does wander, and I think about things like, which dogs will get to run at the sled dog race? And I think it's these six. And then, or I might think about, like, if I had a new litter of sled dog pups, what theme would I choose to name them all? And it's just everything about these guys is so much fun. And just being out there with them is just, it's all about them. I don't think about bills or emails or what I have to do next. I just think about that run, that day, and how well it's going. And when it goes well, it's a really great day. Right, guys?
Danielle Kading is a reporter with the Superior Bureau of Wisconsin Public Radio. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Steve Gotcher.
Coming up, we'll learn about non-fungible tokens, or NFTs, what they are, and why people are spending lots of money on them. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. The market for digital images took off last year with the rise of what are called non-fungible tokens, or NFTs for short. Celebrities, corporations, even politicians are getting in on the NFT boom, and especially artists, with sales reaching just under $25 billion in 2021. But not many of us, including me, really understand what they are, how they work, or why people buy them. Josh White is an assistant professor of finance at Vanderbilt University. He was previously a financial economist for the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Josh, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Give me it in a sense that a radio host can understand, what is a non-fungible token?
Yeah, that's the billion-dollar question right now.
So, literally. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. So let's start with fungible versus non-fungible. So a fungible asset, that's something you can exchange pretty easily. So if I gave you a $20 bill, you could give me two $10 bills and they would have the same value. So it's pretty fungible. So in the crypto space, you know, Bitcoin is actually fungible. It's a fungible token. If I give you one Bitcoin, you can give me one Bitcoin back and we have the same thing. But for a non-fungible asset, that has to be unique and non-divisible. So, you know, your car that you drove to work today, your house, those are very unique assets. They're one of a kind. So a non-fungible token is a way to represent sort of any unique asset and do so on the blockchain.
And the blockchain is what kind of guarantees its uniqueness, I guess. What are some of the range of things we've seen turned into these sellable but non-replicatable, I guess, NFTs?
Yeah. So it's exactly that. You know, most of these are based on Ethereum, which is a blockchain technology that gave us the Ethereum or Ether cryptocurrency. So a lot of the early rage with NFTs came from digital art. You know, if you own the Mona Lisa, we know that has an intrinsic value and that's pretty easy. But if you're a digital artist, then your files or your art can be sort of easily and endlessly duplicated. And so with an NFT, the reason it took off is because you can tokenize that art and it allows the content creator to monetize that. And I can give you a digital certificate of ownership and it's unique and that ownership can be verified.
So say I become an artist, not going to happen, but say I do and I paint Mona Lisa 2022 by Rob. I can send all sorts of images, people can copy them, but I can declare one to be the unique one, give it this Ethereum blockchain code that makes it unique. I've just created an NFT. Did I do it right?
You did it right. You got that right. And I don't know what the value would be. I haven't seen your art.
Oh, it's very, very low.
You know, where this took off to sort of in the early stage is in collectibles. So it moved from art to collectibles. There's something called NBA Top Shot, where when I was a kid, I would collect baseball cards. But these are collections of digital highlights, and you can trade the digital highlights with other people that collect them. And so these NFTs allow sort of a community to build around collecting digital content.
So for my Mona Lisa 2022, anybody can have this image, but somebody puts value in having the unique image of that. And that's what gives it value if people are willing to pay for it. That's what's going on with any of these NFTs, right?
Yeah, so the scarcity gives it some value. And, you know, NFTs also can provide content access. And so using the same blockchain technology, you can control who has access to certain content. So if you had some content that you put somewhere on a website, you could have a certain number of NFTs that you sell, and only those that held that would be able to access that content.
Talking to Josh White, assistant professor of finance at Vanderbilt University, looking at these non-fungible tokens, these NFTs, a lot of money in them last year. And we're figuring out what they are, how they work. Now, here's a twist. Some congressional candidates in both parties, even Melania Trump, have sold NFTs for fundraising purposes. This people said this could raise weird questions when it comes to campaign finance and the transparency of who's getting money from whom. What do you think of the political frontiers of this?
Yeah, so we're not too surprised to see it start to spill over in the political space, and some companies are starting to issue these as well. I mean, we know that campaigning is expensive, so they're always looking for sort of unique ways to raise capital to finance that. Some of the questions that come up are exactly what you touched on. You know, we want to make sure we have election commissions that limit the amount of money that anyone can donate to a campaign, and so your candidates would not want to run afoul of those sort of campaign finance laws. So the big concern is how they're paying to acquire the NFT. Are they paying with what we call fiat currency, with dollar bills, or are they paying with cryptocurrency? And if it's a cryptocurrency payment, then there's a potential that you can obfuscate who's actually making the donation.
I've seen some people point toward a benefit of selling these tokens, especially in the art world, where an artist can make money, which can be tough to do if you're creating digital art in particular, knowing that once it's out there, anybody can copy it. Do you see that as an upside here?
I do see it as an upside, and we've even seen larger companies start to do this. AP, the Associated Press, they have a large stock of photos, and they're starting to sell, a picture of planet Earth that maybe AP has the rights to. And so I think you will see this across the spectrum of artists and companies and entities looking for a way to monetize some of the assets that they have.
I've seen some people argue, Josh, that this is kind of a wave of the future cutting edge technology, but there seems to be suspicion out there that this is just some sort of elaborate consensual hallucination that's going to come crashing down someday. Where are you on that spectrum?
Yeah, it's, the last 12 months, it's been very difficult to predict things. We had meme stocks, and we had a wave of this, and we saw the stock market do things that looked pretty irrational. I think the NFT technology and, what it's going to do and how it's going to transform business, I think this might be the lasting technology that comes out of this sort of crypto craze that's actually really useful. And so we're seeing a lot of companies talk about something known as the metaverse, and I think NFTs will be very important there, as you access and monetize content in this space.
If somebody's out there listening thinking, hey, this sounds kind of cool, I'd love to buy something like a digital baseball card or a artist series or something like that, I would not know how to start. How would somebody get into the game here?
Yeah, I would first say I worked at the SEC, so first be careful. a lot of times when we have new technologies, we fall victim to something known as the fear of missing out. And so we enter into something we're not familiar with, and there's usually somebody on the other side looking to take some money. But I would look at a platform like OpenSea. It's the sort of largest marketplace for trading crypto collectibles. If nothing else, it's fun to see what's being sold, what the values are, who's paying these enormous amount of monies for NFTs. And then also, if it's collectibles, you could think about something like NBA Top Shop, and you could go look at those basketball highlights and see who's paying what for a LeBron James slam dunk. And so those are two places I would start.
Now, I'm not going to ask you for personalized financial advice, but I know some people are using these as vehicles for investment or maybe speculation, if you call it that. What kind of cautions would you have for somebody who thinks of, hey, I'm going to get into this and make lots of money buying and selling these things?
Yeah, so my advice would be, I think it's fine to, so when we think about finance, and so we teach this in our class, we're really not trying to maximize wealth. We're trying to maximize our happiness or utility. And unfortunately, things are expensive. And so usually happiness follows with wealth because we need money to buy things. So I think it's okay to go out and invest and dabble in something like this with small amounts. If it's making you happy and you view it as entertainment, and you lose small amounts of money, I think that's okay. You know, if you take your retirement savings and you put a really large amount of money in the space, then that's when it starts to get troublesome.
As we wrap up, Josh, you said you're a baseball card guy. I was too for a while. Is there something you could see yourself dabbling in similar to your old baseball card hobby?
I have bought some of the highlights on this NBA Top Shot. And it's interesting. I think that, you know, when we were kids, it was always the scarce card that brought the, you know, that's the one everybody wanted, the rare Mickey Mantle or whatever. And it's interesting to see that it's the same thing in this space. You see the highlights that there's fewer of those available. They bring more money, and as the players start to do better, the value of those highlights increase. So that's kind of fun to watch.
Josh, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
Josh White is an assistant professor of finance at Vanderbilt University with us to explain non-fungible tokens, or NFTs, and their increasing popularity. Wonder if there's one of the Kurt Bevacqua Major League Baseball bubblegum championship card. That was a favorite of mine as a kid. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll answer a Wisconsin listener question about Wisconsin Dells and how it became one of the top tourist destinations in the Midwest. That and more tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then President Biden renewed calls to expand voting rights in a speech in Atlanta yesterday. We'll find out where those efforts stand, some of the roadblocks, and the response the speech is getting from Republicans. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.